Christopher.
Robert.
How are you?
A bit early to say.
Yeah, I agree. So you probably need no introduction, right? I mean, you're a columnist at Slate and Vanity Fair and author of God Is Not Great, among other books. But is there anything else you want to say?
No, that'll do it.
You think so?
Yeah.
Paperback
of God Is Not Great, available at fine bookstores everywhere.
I'm sorry, I left that part off. I don't know. Maybe because it wasn't my book. I forgot that part. After many years, I finally made your acquaintance at La Ciudad de las Ideas in Puebla, Mexico, a few weeks ago. And I guess that's one factor that led to this happening. And I gather the idea, well, if I don't know who does, but I think the idea is that we're going to talk about foreign policy, and then we're going to have a second discussion about religion. Is that your understanding?
That was what I was told, sure.
And I guess there are some differences between my views on foreign policy and yours, which certainly came to my attention during the Iraq War, and maybe at some point we should talk about that. Is there anything you want to say by way of characterizing our differences or anything else?
The differences between us, which I'm pluralizing on purpose, I think became manifest specifically in what you wrote about Major Hassan's attack on his fellow soldiers at Fort Hood.
Right.
And in particular, you're saying that it should lead us to a greater understanding of religious rage. I think, we obviously can't assume, can we, that our audience already knows
how we rehearsed that.
So shall I just say why I thought you were wrong?
Well, let me say what I think. Well,
why don't you say what you thought first? Yes, that's better.
I think I was just making the point that given that everyone seems to agree that among the factors that drove him over the edge was his outrage over the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, however unstable he was to begin with, for whatever reasons of personal circumstance. That one thing to keep in mind about the Iraq and Afghanistan wars was that this is a potential cost of them to push people perhaps disposed to radical Islamism over the edge. And more broadly, I said that really this particular dynamic was consistent with what I think had been the kind of the left-wing view of the war on terror to begin with. At least it was a view that I espoused, which was that you shouldn't focus so much on killing the terrorists that you spread the terrorist meme, which I would say is what we did in this case. So that's kind of my argument.
Well, perhaps paradoxically, I'd want to start by agreeing with you. I mean, at least you didn't make any bones about the Islamist element in Major Hassan's actions. If you recall, there was at least a week where everyone was trying to find out any other explanation than that, including quite senior people in the armed forces. They said, okay, this terrible thing's happened. The first thing we must do is not find that it's related to his religion. The president seemed to imply that in what he said. It took about a week before it was very clear. Yes, he had shouted Allahu Akbar. Yes, he'd bought the weapon off base a long time before. Yes, he'd been in touch with Imam al-Awlaki, a very dangerous person wanted in connection with the 9/11 hijackers who were his friends. And yes, it turned out to be true that a few weeks before the atrocity at Fort Hood, Imam al-Awlaki had given a general theocratic permission on his website and in his broadcasts for attacks on American soldiers anywhere. So, I mean, I think the presumption of guilt is in respect of Major Hassan's fanaticism is pretty high. So to that extent, we agree. Good. Now let me put the case of Sergeant Papadopoulos, a soldier from Chicago of Greek-American ancestry. The island of Cyprus has been under Turkish military occupation now for a lot of years, ever since 1974. Partition, occupation, expulsion of Greeks. The United States has a very warm military relationship with Turkey. Are you telling me that if Sergeant Papadopoulos was suddenly to pack a clip into his gun and spray everyone around him on base, that this would be a wake-up call for our understanding that Greeks feel really very strongly indeed about Turkish imperialism? I don't think you'd do any such thing. There's a special privilege given to religious fanaticism in these cases, and I think it should be stopped.
I'm not sure I think
religious fanaticism, in other words, makes it worse, not better. And the second thing is, if you're looking for how to diagnose Muslim outrage, once you start, you can't stop. I mean, what will it be this time? Will it be a cartoon in an obscure newspaper in Denmark? Leads to riots and killings and burnings and lynchings all around the world? Who would have known that was going to happen? A rumor printed in Newsweek about the defacement of a Quran in Guantanamo Bay leads to violence. The sight of women unveiled can lead to violence. The existence of homosexuals or Jews can lead to Muslim violence. If you want to take out an insurance policy and say, let's not do anything to upset these people, there won't be anything much you can do, not in remain as you are, at any rate, on the liberal left, because everything that you care about the most, tolerance of sexual diversity, emancipation of women, protection of the Jewish people from genocidal threats, right of newspapers to publish cartoons and editorials, all of that's gone because you can't be too careful. This is no way to live, and I won't live like that for a minute.
Well, you don't have to worry about me living that way for a minute either. You've successfully carried my logic to an extreme that goes well beyond where I would have taken it. So we don't have to worry about...
Not an extreme.
You shouldn't stop genocide because it may offend someone. But if we could get back to where we started before this pretty epic extrapolation, do you agree with me that we can say that this is a cost of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars in this one case, and not the only one actually on American soil, and may be something generically to worry about? Do you think it exemplifies a cost? I mean, I think you'd agree that before we launch wars, to the extent that we can, we should do a kind of a cost-benefit analysis, or maybe you disagree. But do you agree that we've just seen a cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, the 9/11 hijackers and the al-Qaeda cells were in the United States well before the United States was in Afghanistan or Iraq.
Right.
The Taliban had taken over Afghanistan, banned music, right. Banned women from appearing in public.
Right.
Found new and even more cruel ways of executing homosexuals, and issued proclamations calling for the death of all Jews and all Hindus and all secularists long before the United States.
Right. So we can exclude the hypothesis.
No, in other words, I flat out disagree with you. Islamic extremism, Islamic fascistic rhetoric and behavior is not created by the resistance to it. No. All the evidence
we
have is to the contrary.
Right. Not every instance of it is caused by that. Does that mean to you that not any instance of it could be caused by that? That would seem strange to me.
Well, I have no doubt that the latest Taliban attack on a girls' school in Afghanistan is motivated in their minds by the presence of American troops in the country and certainly justified by them in public that way. But believe me, they'd be throwing acid in the faces of unveiled girls trying to go to school, whether we were there or not. So no. This is not produced by our resistance to it. Actually, the evidence is all to the contrary. In all the sermons of Osama bin Laden that were broadcast and that we have easy access to before the horrific attack on our civil society in September of 2001, all of those celebrate American weakness. They say, we will win because you notice how the United States has scuttled from Somalia. They're retreating all around the world. Their country is run by feminists and Jews and queers. Defeating them will be simple. Their rallying call was that America is weak, not that it's prepared to fight.
Christopher, I'm willing to concede that doing nothing ever militarily could have that downside. Okay, I'm just asking, are you willing to concede what seems to me obvious, that the Iraq war, which you championed, and the Afghanistan war, had at least this one downside? You're denying it? As I understand your argument, what you're saying is, wait, there was Islamist terrorism before the Iraq war, so it's impossible that any manifestation of Islamist terrorism could have been caused by the Iraq war. Is that your position?
The thing itself is not created by the Iraq war, is my position. Now, you're dealing with something I know you well enough to know, not just from meeting you, but from your writings. You recognize as a fallacy, which is that of post hoc propter hoc. I'd suppose it could be argued that the decision by al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia to blow up the most sacred shrine of the Shia people, that the Golden Dome Mosque in Samarra, might not have occurred if there were no American forces in the country. That's possible, but I think it's unlikely, because there are many countries where there are no American forces, such as Pakistan, for example, where the al-Qaeda extremists blow up Sunni mosques as a matter of principle.
What, you think
the Hazara people of Afghanistan, the Shia population, who were partly ethnically Persian, for example, were nearly destroyed under Taliban rule. In fact, at one point, Iran itself was considering invading Afghanistan to put a stop to that religious, clerical, ethnic atrocity until President Clinton stopped them from crossing the border. So, no, in no significant extent, to no significant extent, is this religious terrorism attributable to our decision to fight against it.
Well, if you think that mosque would have been blown up anyway, even if we had not invaded Iraq and Saddam Hussein had been allowed to maintain his iron grip on the country, I think it's safe to say you're in a minority, which I know is not a position you're afraid to be
no,
in.
No, I actually said that I thought that particular one probably wouldn't have, but in general, the decision to declare the Shia to be heretics and put to the sword precedes our intervention there, just as, for example, the decision of the Islamic insurgents in Algeria, where there were never any foreign troops,
to
announce that anyone who didn't agree with them was under the precept of takfir, excommunicated, liable to death, had nothing to do at all with the Western presence in the country. It was sui generis.
You know, you mentioned school opposition to the bill to letting girls go to school and things like that in Afghanistan is one thing that incites Islamism. The implication being that of course doesn't mean we shouldn't champion it just because it incites radical Islamism. There's a book called Three Cups of Tea. Are you familiar with that? By this guy Greg, it's Morrison or something. Who?
Yes, I know of the book. I haven't read it.
Very courageously has gone around Afghanistan building schools either for girls or co-ed schools so that girls in Afghanistan can have an education. And if you read that book, and that book has actually been commended, I believe, to American troops, or at least soldiers who are studying counterinsurgency doctrine by I believe General Petraeus. In any event, there's a good vignette in there of him showing a moderate Muslim who is explaining how much damage the Iraq War did and the imagery generated by the Iraq War did to his own desire to foster moderation within Islam and what a handy tool it is for terrorist recruiters. It sounds like you're willing to acknowledge.
You're trying to apply reason and logic where it really doesn't work. A huge number of people have joined the jihad because they believe that the Israelis blew up the World Trade Center and that all the Jews left the World Trade Center just in time. I can't stop them from having that impression, but the impression they have comes not from any contact with reality or any reaction to objective circumstances, but from the belief in a fanatical religion. That's my first, last, and closing point on all of these things.
Well, but it's an assertion.
Now, if there wasn't a bomb that had fallen on an Afghan wedding, say, due to the incompetence of NATO and its refusal to commit ground troops, things of this kind, avoidable things, I'm sure the problem would be, to that slight extent, less. But in defining the problem, you're simply looking at the wrong diagnosis. You talk about Iraq. The Kurdish people of Iraq, as you know, as everyone knows, were subjected to poison gas, to chemical weaponry, to an explicit genocidal campaign, Quranically named, actually, by Saddam Hussein, the Anfal. It's a verse from the Quran about how you can plunder and destroy people.
Yep.
Deported, fill in mass graves. Nothing was spared them. When a bomb goes off,
in Iraq
or anywhere else, I know who it won't be. It will not be my Kurdish comrades who fought so hard for a free Iraq. They could claim justification for anything after what's been done to them. They don't do this kind of thing. And you discredit them when you say that, well, if you've suffered or if you think you're suffering or you've been insulted, you have the right to resort to violence. And if you it's our fault.
Christopher, this is such a fundamental misunderstanding of what I'm saying. And
I wish it was.
What you're saying, if I could talk for just a little while, what you're saying is that when I point to a downside of something we've done, I point to a cost incurred by American action, including a crime that I'm saying was ultimately resulted from American action, in this case, the murder of people at Fort Hood, what you're saying is that I'm justifying that murder, and I'm assigning blame to America. And
you
I'm
say,
emphatically,
I think
I'm
you
not
just
only,
said.
Christopher, I'm not only emphatically not doing that, I've repeatedly said I'm not doing that, and what you're doing is a favorite talking point on the right, which is whenever anyone points to an unfortunate consequence of American policy and suggests that maybe we should revise our thinking about that policy in light of the consequence, they say, oh, you're blaming America, you're blaming America. No, we're not, but saying we're blaming America is a very effective way, given human psychology, to shut off debate, intelligent debate entirely, which is what the American right wants, and which is the only effect of what you're doing.
When our viewers replay what you just said, I think they will hear you say that the murder by a man who'd sworn a Hippocratic oath of his unarmed colleagues at Fort Hood was a consequence of American action. I think it would
not have happened had we not launched those two wars.
Well, that's correct. All I wanted to do was to get you to say that. I'm content now. I think you've definitely made your point.
I think there are all kinds of crimes that are committed that would not have committed but for some circumstance. That doesn't mean it's a legally or morally mitigating circumstance. It just means
it's a fact
about the way causality works in the physical universe that things are that complex. And
you
to the extent that you can take
this,
that into account in your thinking about policy,
I think you shouldn't. You regard this to you as a physical law?
No, I didn't say it was a physical law.
You seem to imply it a second ago.
Well, I'm a materialist. All laws are grounded in the workings of the physical world. Yes, all causal laws.
Yeah, I too am a materialist, but
good.
I'm very preoccupied for that reason with the question of whether or not we have free will. But there's certainly many people, individuals and nations, who've been very badly maltreated, who do not resort to sadistic violence and claim that God ordered them to undertake it.
There certainly are, and there are people who smoke cigarettes and don't get lung cancer. Does that mean that cigarettes are not a contributing factor to lung cancer, and that they, in certain isolated cases, are what pushed the person over the edge into lung cancer? You're saying that's not the case?
Again, I'm very happy just to have you say that. I couldn't make my point better.
No, I think you made the opposite of your point.
You're saying
that if I can show someone who was exposed to the type of circumstance that in one case caused X, and it doesn't in this case you point to cause X, then it can't be a contributing factor and can in no case cause X. That's what you're saying, and I'm saying no. The fact that cigarettes sometimes don't cause lung cancer doesn't mean that they don't in any individual.
Good.
Is that all? I win?
No, I just want everyone to hear you say all that.
Okay, good, and they can replay it as often as they like. Now, do you want to talk about the Iraq War broadly?
Sure.
So, because I do think it's kind of, it delimits our worldviews pretty effectively. But first of all, you don't agree with me, I gather, that in terms of international law, the Iraq War was a pretty dubious enterprise.
Well, international law itself in some areas is rather dubious, but there have been there are four conditions, it's generally thought, under which a state, a government, can lose its sovereignty. One is if it invades and occupies the territories of neighboring states. The other is if it commits genocide. That's if you're a signatory to the Genocide Convention, which we are. The third is violations of at least the spirit of a non-proliferation treaty. In other words, fooling around with illegal acquisition of nuclear weapons. And the fourth is giving aid and comfort and hospitality to nihilistic international gangster groups. Now, Iraq was guilty of all four of those things on more than one occasion. It was a serial offender under all four. Hadn't been punished for them at the time it was doing them, but had put itself way outside the law. And after the attempt to annex Kuwait, to destroy a neighboring country, not just to occupy and invade it, but to abolish its existence, a member state of the UN and of the Arab League, signed a ceasefire with the United States on condition of which its regime was allowed to retain power. Many of us thought at the time that was a mistake. It continued to violate all the terms of that ceasefire. It seems to me that it would have been much better to have put an end to the Saddam Hussein regime in 1991. It would have spared the Iraqi people some terrible years of suffering and misery. And it would have shown that the United Nations was serious about disciplining members that don't have any respect for international law. But if you believe the only violations of international law, or the only important ones, are committed by those who consider Saddam Hussein to be an outlaw, I certainly know where you're coming from. I'm familiar with that viewpoint.
Well, so what you're saying is there's these four causes, four things that legitimize invasion, or at least strip a nation of its immunity to invasion.
Yes.
One of them is having invaded another country?
Yes.
You're talking about Kuwait?
Kuwait and Iran.
Well, okay, but I mean, you know, Kuwait, you know, of course the Iran war...
And I suppose one might add the launching of indiscriminate missile attacks on the state of Israel, which was a non-combatant in the Kuwait war.
I can go on
if you like about that.
Okay, but of course the Kuwait war, I mean, that was the most recent infraction we're talking about. The Kuwait war had been literally dealt with under international law. The Security Council got together, rolled back the aggression, dropped a lot of bombs, killed a lot of Iraqi soldiers. It could have, if it wanted to, inflicted more punishment, but the body in charge of enforcing that bit of international law chose not to.
Certain conditions that Iraq signed at the ceasefire agreement on the border,
right.
which later broke. The Saddam Hussein crime family, which considered itself to be, and in fact was,
well, that's
the
separate,
owner of the owner of everybody and all property within Iran.
First of all, that's a separate matter from the invasion per se, which just had been dealt with. So I don't think that particular leg of your argument holds up. Now, you're right. Subsequently, as a result of the invasion, Iraq agreed to do some things with respect to its nuclear weapons, and you say that another justification is fooling around with weapons of mass destruction, another justification for invasion. That strikes me as the most ridiculous of the four, because, of course, Iraq had let the inspectors in, and they were not denied access to a single facility that they asked to inspect, and there's no doubt that if George Bush had been earnest about wanting to find out if there were indeed ongoing infractions, he could have gotten, for the rest of eternity pretty much, to continue searching for weapons in exchange for holding off the invasion. So the idea that we had to invade to find out that they didn't have nuclear weapons is ridiculous.
The question of the great thesaurus of United Nations resolutions that was accumulated by diplomacy over the years was this: would Iraq come into compliance with the resolutions that confirmed its disarmament? Now, you're not going to tell me that you think Iraq ever came into compliance. A bizarre thing observed by many people inside and outside Iraq was the apparent unwillingness of Saddam Hussein to admit he didn't have weapons, even if he didn't. He wanted people to think that he did. He wanted to keep everybody permanently on tenterhooks. They never came into compliance. That's why the United Nations Security Council voted unanimously before the business of the second resolution was brought up by Mr. Blair, to say that they weren't in compliance and serious consequences would naturally follow. I myself would have thought that was authority enough. I wish the second resolution debate had not been allowed to muddy the waters.
You didn't take his admitting the inspectors and letting them go wherever they wanted as a way of saying,
He did not let them go wherever they wanted. He wouldn't allow, for example,
he
you to...
He absolutely did.
No.
I encourage people to fact-check this and come up with a single facility, Christopher. Come up with a single facility. I don't expect you to have it at your fingertips now, but I would like somebody to point to a facility to which the inspectors were denied
access.
Well,
you're barking up the wrong tree there. For example, the inspectors were not allowed to take Iraqi scientists out of the country to interview them.
That is true.
They weren't allowed to use the U-2 overflights. There was in existence a Ministry of Concealment, an actual office of the Iraqi state run by one of Saddam Hussein's sons, designed for the bamboozlement of inspectors. Rolf Ekias, who I know very well, who was the head of the UN inspectorate in the first round and whose reappointment was blocked by France and Russia for reasons that are too obvious to go into, told me he was offered a direct bribe by Tariq Aziz, the foreign minister of Saddam Hussein, to try and alter his reports. If they asked Rolf Ekias, it means they were trying to bribe everybody. We have no reason to think that it didn't work, at least some of the time, as the Oil for Food program was being used to corrupt the United Nations process as well. And we know from the memoirs of Dr. Mahdi Obeidi, Saddam Hussein's chief nuclear scientist, that he himself was ordered to bury a centrifuge in his garden and did. And we have the open record. We have the open record of that being dug up and shown on camera. That was all for anyone to see. They tried to bury what they had against the day when the sanctions would break down and Saddam Hussein would be out of his famous box. The presumption of guilt in the case of Saddam Hussein and double dealing on WMD is absolute.
But the accusation was that he had nuclear weapons and an active nuclear program.
No, actually, it wasn't that he had nuclear weapons. It was that he had
had a plan
to reacquire and maintain the expertise to
right. And
chemical and biological weapons.
And if you have the free run of the country and can go anywhere you want, it's not hard to establish whether that is or is not the case.
How many inspectors were there?
You know, if you know as well as
How
I do,
big is Iraq?
You know as well as I do that if George Bush had been earnest and had not just been looking for an excuse to invade and had said at the last minute, I will hold off on invasion if we multiply by 10 the number of inspectors and give them another 2 years, you know damn well the Security Council would have done it in a minute. And in any event, if he didn't think they would, he could have tried, but he didn't try because he didn't want to avoid the war. Now, it's fine to point to technical senses in which Saddam Hussein was still in noncompliance, but if what you're saying is there was some kind of serious effort to find out whether he had nuclear weapons, and in the end, invasion was the only option, that is utter nonsense, and I think you would have to agree with that.
The President's speech to the United Nations on September 11, 2002, mentions that as only one of four major objections to the continuing private ownership of Iraq by this psychopathic crime family. But I think it's good enough because, as an argument, yes, because that regime was the only one that we knew had both acquired and concealed the acquisition of and the manufacture of and then later used on neighbors and on its own population weapons of mass destruction. Now, that's a very grave state of affairs. It wasn't punished at the time it should have been, but it's been punished now. And I find I'm not sorry that Saddam Hussein is no longer the private owner of Iraq with his terrible his terrible son.
Oh, I'm not sorry about that part. There are just other questions. That's definitely an upside. I mean, I think perhaps more than you, I will concede the upside of policies I oppose. Most policies have some upsides. But right now, I mean, to focus on that right there, you're talking about Anfal, which people argue about whether it comports with the definition of genocide in the strictest sense. But leave that aside. The fascinating thing about that is, as you know, the American government was a supporter of Saddam Hussein's when he conducted that campaign in its aftermath.
Absolutely.
And with considerable knowledge of the fact that he had conducted it,
yes.
The American government, if anything, redoubled its support of Saddam Hussein and, in fact, shared with him.
I'm painfully well aware of that and tried to draw attention to it.
That
seems to me absolutely to undermine your main point. The more that's true, the more we incur the responsibility to put right what we did wrong before.
Oh, I see. So we can abet a horrible crime, and then we are the policeman who punishes the other guy that we abetted without punishing ourselves. This leads to a larger point, the absurdity that I'm just highlighting, Christopher.
If you find you've been complicit in a terrible crime against humanity, which the Anfal crime was, and you seem to argue a moment ago that it doesn't fit the definition of genocide. It certainly fits the definition that says that there is a plan to exterminate in whole or in part the national existence of a people. If you find you've been under a previous regime, another incarnation, as a nation responsible for that, I would say it doubles your responsibility to cancel that obligation. Wouldn't you want to agree?
This leads to another point. The idea of America having been an accomplice to this crime, then getting in high dudgeon about the crime and invading him on the basis of it, the irony of that underscores a larger point hovering over this whole discussion of international law.
I'm not sure I see the irony there.
What? You don't see the irony.
Irony is
well,
a word that's very precious.
I think
to
irony,
you.
At a minimum, it qualifies as, you know, whether it's, maybe we could have an argument as to whether it's a paradox that should cripple the policy you advocate, but I don't think anyone would deny irony, Christopher.
Well, if only irony was just paradox. No, it's actually something that's rather literal rather than ironic. You have incurred, by being not just a bystander, which would have been bad enough, but as you correctly point out, an accomplice in a terrible crime against humanity. It seems to me you acquire, you definitely take upon yourself the responsibility to redeem that horrific complicity and neutrality. And I'm very glad to say that instead of filling mass graves in Iraq, the United States is now helping the Iraqi and Kurdish people to dig them up and to put on trial those who murdered them.
This brings us to a larger point, the idea of the United States taking on that responsibility. And
no, not taking on. Excuse me, that's exactly the opposite word. Not taking on. Accepting, realizing, saying, yes, it's true. We can't wash our hands of this.
In any event, I mean, there's a larger question hovering over our discussion of international law here. There's the question of whether you know you delineated these crimes that you say qualifies under international law. I actually think there's a problem probably with each of them, including you know the question of why we didn't punish him at the time. And I would say in the case of his undeniably abetting terrorism, well, if we invaded every country that abets terrorism, first of all, we'd be invading some allies. We'd be invading Pakistan now, not to get the Taliban, to get the government. Okay, because they have, I think you'd agree, Pakistan has abetted terrorism. That seems to me not a policy we're consistently enforcing.
Yes,
and indeed,
in the name of God.
We might on reflection invade ourselves, given the fact that we have supported things like extra-legal death squads, which are, if they're morally distinct in an important way from terrorism, it's a distinction that eludes me. Okay, but above again, hovering above all of
well, then what you just said would be a very convenient way of making all moral action impossible.
Well, it would.
You're
it would
making
make,
the best
it would
enemy
make
of
people,
the good, and
it would make
then you're denying
reflect.
The possibility of doing even a bit of good.
No, I've actually got a way to get around that, which leads to the point I've been trying to get at. Hovering above all of this discussion of international law is the separate question of who is authorized to enforce it. If I go in and break down my neighbor's door and I say, look, there are illegal drugs in here, and there indeed are, that does not mean I've acted lawfully, right?
No,
now,
I wouldn't say
now,
so.
Now, some of us who are very serious about constructing a system of international law that will really merit the term, which admittedly we may not have here, would like, whenever possible, to actually exercise the legitimate mechanisms of enforcement of international law. In this case, the Security Council, okay, not the United States. If we let every country, if you said it was legitimate for every country in the world to go around invading anyone that they deemed guilty of any of the four things that you just outlined, the world would be chaos, okay, if that freedom were actually exercised. Some of us would rather rely on a body of international law like the Security Council, which, of course, has often been paralyzed and inactive, and ironically, in this case, had been unprecedentedly effective in getting the inspectors into Iraq to determine whether Iraq was or was not guilty of the primary allegation against it.
And
I think one of the costs of the Iraq War was that we let that potentially valuable precedent not only wither, but it kind of backfired. It made nations, if anything, less inclined to comply with the dictates of the Security Council. If after all, you're going to get invaded, whether you do or whether you comply with the fundamental spirit of it or not.
Right.
So it's
hard to know quite at which point to.
There's one point. The U.S. is not judge, jury, and executioner, Christopher. That's the point. It's just a simple point.
So you think, say, that the self-evident flouting of all the laws governing non-proliferation by the current regime in Iran is not opposed by Russia or China? Just because they think the Americans made a mistake in Iraq. The Russians and Chinese would otherwise be in full compliance at the Security Council and saying, yes, it's true, the Iranians have broken all the rules, we have to do something about it.
No, I don't believe that. Why do you think I did?
I'm so glad to hear you don't. So take another case, Rwanda, where the United States actually vetoed the proposal to double the strength of the UN force preemptively because they knew that the genocide was in preparation. Everybody knows now how terrible our abstinence and our neutrality were. They weren't even neutral. In the end, it was abstention on behalf of the genocideur, of the Hutu mass murderers. Now, suppose it had been the other way. The UN says, right, we should send a vast mission of aid and defense to Rwanda and do it swiftly so as to prevent the near extermination of half its people. Which member state do you think would have got the job of actually producing the planes, the troops, the massive drops of food and medicine and so on? You know very well it wouldn't have been Belgium. It wouldn't have been China. It wouldn't have been Russia either. The United States is not just the host country and one of the founder countries of the United Nations. It's the one without which it doesn't work. And, for example,
right,
if your advice had been followed, the Slobodan Milosevic would still be he might actually have died by no natural causes, but he would have spent some time being the president of a greater Serbia that included a destroyed Bosnia, a massacred Bosnia, and a cleansed Kosovo.
The
United States, in my opinion, quite rightly decided by the way, I'll add this, the Muslim populations of the Balkans, the Kosovar mm-hmm. and Bosnian ones, on a NATO initiative, and said that since the United Nations is never going to do anything about this, mm-hmm. that doesn't mean we have to watch the recrudescence of National Socialism in Europe. I thought that was a great thing, and I think it should be added to what we'd said earlier, that why doesn't Major Hassan say, well, you have to give it to the United States. If it wasn't for them, all the Muslims of mm-hmm. Balkan Europe would have been killed. Mm-hmm. No one ever says that. No action is attributable to a U.S. action like that. It's only attributable to the U.S. when it's the other way around, supposedly. We actually saved Kuwait, a Muslim country, from destruction. We saved Afghanistan from right. beggary and slavery. We saved Iraq from a terrible fascist dictator and the Iraqi people, the Shia majority of whom are very grateful to us, and the Kurdish ones too. None of this is ever counted in, is it? When the question of terrorism and irrational theocratic violence is being discussed.
You're kind of changing you're covering a lot of things here, let's say.
I'm trying to make it consistent with our earlier discussion.
Yeah. You said that if I had my way, we would not have intervened in Bosnia. I can point you to columns I wrote long before the American government finally decided to support intervention there, advocating intervention. B.
What about the UN?
What if
the UN is against, as it was?
Actually, I don't think the UN, in the end, I think that did get UN support, did it not?
It certainly wasn't done with the United Nations permission.
In any event, what I argued at the time was that this was actually a clear-cut violation on a couple of grounds, okay? It was, first, there was trans-border aggression because the boundaries within the former Yugoslavia had already been recognized when that was taking place. So Serbia was crossing, it was trans-border aggression, as I said, it was.
Yes.
And unlike the case you bring up with Saddam Hussein, it wasn't something that had happened 10 years ago and already been punished, as with the Kuwait invasion. It was happening now. The ethnic cleansing / genocide was happening now, okay? So it's not at all comparable to what you're talking about in Iraq.
I was addressing myself to your view, derived, I'm not quite sure from where, that the only lawful authority for the use of force in international relations is the Security Council of the United Nations. I don't think that is a very easy view to hold if you're as consistent as
I would not say
things like human rights and genocide.
I would not say that if there is a clear-cut, for example, ongoing genocide, you should be paralyzed by the Security Council's failure to act. I concede that the bodies of international law have not yet evolved to a point where we can rely on them wholly.
Well, how are you thinking about Iran now, for example? I mean, what more proof do you need that the Iranian regime is outside the law, both at home and abroad? The United Nations, do you expect the United Nations to take up this responsibility? I'd ask you a straight question.
This is another case where, first of all...
Do you expect them to take it up?
What's that?
Do you expect the United Nations to become seized of the matter, that Iran is in absolutely open, contemptuous defiance of all the treaties it's ever signed, all the undertakings it's ever made, to the European Union, to the International Atomic Energy Authority, to the NPT, and to the UN itself. Do you suppose that now the United Nations, faced with this undeniable state of affairs, is going to help to disarm Iran? Do you or don't you?
Iran raises two questions. If you ask me what I would like the Security Council to do...
No, I didn't ask you that.
Why,
since I did ask you a direct question, why pick the one I didn't ask?
Okay, what'd you ask?
Do you expect the United Nations to live up to its evident responsibilities in this respect?
Actually, I think it's not so clear here what the evident responsibilities are. I think experts tell me it's not so clear that we would have to stop anything Iran is evidently doing to keep it in compliance with a non-proliferation treaty. What we would have to do, and this I would support, and this is something we have not offered Iran, by the way, in the terms I'm about to describe. We have not said to Iran, if you let inspectors go wherever they want, more or less, in keeping with the so-called additional protocol to the NPT, you can enrich nuclear materials for verifiably peaceful purposes. As long as we can monitor and these inspectors can go not only to declared sites, but wherever they want, we will let you enrich. That's a deal we have not offered them in those terms. We have said things like, if you let inspectors in, then as confidence grows, and we'll be the ones who determine when confidence has grown, then we may let you enrich and so on. This is a deal that I think would keep Iran within the bounds of the NPT, but it is more likely to accept than anything we've offered. So if you've asked me what I'd like to see, I'd like to see that. Now,
I'd like to see that, too. I really would.
Well, there's a large, and it's one of these things where, why not at least make the offer? Okay, maybe they'd turn it down. Why not at least make the offer? And yet it's not even official American policy
Sure, why not? It helps them run out the clock. It helps them think that this is too easy. It confirms them in their existing long record of contempt and bad behavior. But, why not? It's certainly consistent with everything we've done so far.
Okay, so then, you're against it, I take it.
No, I'm for trying it too, just to convince the last doubter. Why not? But I don't think we have an infinity of time before we have a theocracy that's at war with its own people.
But there,
and threatening its neighbors that will be able to say to us, what do you propose to do about us now that we have thermonuclear capacity?
Well, by the way, speaking of the people that it's at war with, I know one of the criteria by which you make a lot of foreign policy decisions is you're supportive of the forces of democracy. So am I, all other things being equal. There is this irony in Iran, which is that the so-called good guys, the forces of democracy, seem more obstinate even than Ahmadinejad in this particular case. According to the Kremlinologists, if they're to be trusted, Ahmadinejad was in favor of the deal whereby their nuclear materials would have been transported to Russia, and the opposition, and maybe what the critical mass was in the opposition, came from, among other places, from the reformers. But I don't want to get in the way of your...
There are nationalists among the reformers, that's true.
Right.
There's no question about it. But the consistent finding that all measurements, some of them are obviously limited and crude, of measurements of opinion in Iran, where I've been myself and made some inquiries, the very consistent finding is that a majority of Iranians want the restoration of full diplomatic relations with the United States and friendship with America. Now, they have to know that the price of that is not that they give up their nuclear program, but that they give up a nuclear weapons program. We'll build them the reactors. We've said we'd like them to have nuclear capacity because it's so much better than squandering their oil. But such reactors as they do have were mostly built, in any case, by the United States. They can have all that and a lifting of the embargo as well, and a lot of prosperity and free exchange. That's what they want. You're telling, I don't think it's true the Iranian people, given that offer, if they were allowed to vote in their own name and create a government that was in their own image, would say, no, we care so much about the weaponry that we don't want any of that. All the evidence is to the contrary. It's very important, I think, that we become, I say we, not just the United States, people like you and I, become firmer and faster friends of the Iranian democratic movement and ask ourselves every day, what have we done to help them?
Well, I'm certainly not against their taking over, but there is just one, you know, one larger issue that I think frames the Iran case, and that is just, you know, you ask what should the Security Council do. Well, one problematic thing, and I'm sure this seems especially problematic from the point of view of some Iranians, is just a massive inconsistency. The fact that we have let the idea of a consistent non-proliferation regime just completely fall apart. I mean, for example, if Iran tomorrow said, in keeping with the terms of the NPT, we're getting out of the NPT, we're opting out, which you're allowed to do under the NPT, and we're going to build nuclear weapons, then they would have exactly the same standing as Israel, Pakistan, and India. And yet I don't think you would really fundamentally change your view of what we should do about Iran. And granted, the Iranian regime, of all those four regimes, the current Iranian regime is the one I would least like to have nuclear weapons in the hands of. But the larger point is, we are not, you know, we're not able to say to the Iranian people, here is this general principle that we expect you to abide by, that we would expect any nation to abide by. And until we are able to do that...
that's not quite true, because what Iran is doing is building a weapons capacity while remaining a signatory of the NPT.
We don't know that
they want
per se, Christopher.
Yes, we do
not know if they have violated the NPT in a technical sense, I think. At least there are people who know more about it than I do that argue that.
Well, I congratulate them on their lenience and
me too.
Broad-mindedness. The fact is that if it was up to me, the Pakistanis, for example, would never have been able to acquire nuclear weapons by piracy and secret dealing and theft as they did, let alone to share those fissile materials with Libya, North Korea, and others through the nuclear Walmart that we allowed them to run under the regime of AQ Khan. But I might just add here on the point of non-proliferation, the AQ Khan network would never have been uncovered if Colonel Gaddafi had not turned over all his fissile materials to the United States, or potentially fissile ones, and his arsenal, and he wouldn't have done that if it hadn't been for the deposition of Saddam Hussein. So actually the contribution of the intervention in Iraq to non-proliferation globally and in general has been greatly underestimated.
Oh, I beg to differ.
But because it's not my fault or yours, that the states of Pakistan and Israel and others have unlawfully acquired nuclear weapons. But we are faced now with a very aggressive state that's at war with its own people and threatens its neighbors, that uses messianic rhetoric, becoming a thermonuclear power. Now, I just don't like the idea of you wanting to change the subject there. That's true, whatever else is true.
I told you what I would do about it, and I told you why...
You didn't say what you'd do about it. Oh, what? You'd make them a better offer on inspections?
The deal I would offer Iran, yes.
Okay.
And look, if it were my world, you said in your world, Pakistan wouldn't have acquired nuclear weapons. Well, okay, fine, but from the Iranians' point of view, the question is,
if we're allowed
why aren't
to
you
do all that, I mean, I admit, if we're allowed to do all that, I mean, if it was up to me, there would be no such place as Pakistan. India would never have been partitioned, the great post-colonial crime of the British Empire, the greatest probably of all.
And if it were up to me, there would be various larger initiatives being looked at with regard to Iran, which are not politically feasible.
Me too.
But you know, your point about Iraq having contributing to nonproliferation because it may be that it's what led Libya to fess up about its nuclear weapons.
Let me just take
issue with you there. Even if I grant you that not hypothetical, but the unknown, what exactly caused Gaddafi to make up his mind on that, it could well be the war, granted. It equally could well be the case, as I speculated at the time, that once North Korea saw that even if you let inspectors in, you get invaded anyway, that significantly reduced the chances that they would play ball with the international community. And, of course, they've since demonstrably developed nuclear weapons. And that is to me, as plausible a consequence of the Iraq war as the one you posited. But B, more broadly, as I said, what the United Nations had accomplished, and thanks to George Bush, I would add, it was only under the threat of the troops he was amassing that Saddam Hussein let the UN inspectors in. But the fact is,
so what you'd never
that was a vital precedent that could have done great things to nurture the ongoing evolution of a non-proliferation regime. Instead, the opposite happened. This evolution was sabotaged by George Bush, and I still say, on balance, the Iraq War was very bad for the non-proliferation cause.
Well, I spoke to the British diplomat who had been the ambassador in Tripoli. When I met him, he was in Iran at the time, who said that Gaddafi was induced to give up. And remember, he gave up his weapons and he offered his surrender of them, not to Chirac, not to Putin, not to Kofi Annan, not to the European Union. He went first to Blair and then to Bush, suggestive in itself. We got him in three ways. One, we had very good intelligence, better than we had in Iraq, I'll freely concede. We shocked him when we went to him and said how much we knew. The Lockerbie business was becoming totally oppressive to him. The Scottish courts were never going to let up. And three, he was terrified by what he'd seen happen to Saddam Hussein. And when he handed over his material, it was more than we thought he had, mm-hmm. and more advanced as well. It's all mm-hmm. in Oak Ridge, Tennessee now, a good place for it to be. But by analyzing it, said, where the hell did he get this? We walked back the cat. It can only have come from Pakistan. And we shut down, much too late, the AQ Khan network. I think that's a generally positive thing. Robert, to go back to what you were saying before about North Korea, I'm mm-hmm. sorry to say, I keep finding this note of what I'll call masochism in your argument. Whenever anyone behaves badly, it's because they think we've been mean to them, or we've been cruel to them, we've been nasty to them.
You said
the lesson the North Korea drew was if we let in inspectors and gave them free access, it would do us no good. Don't you understand that the whole North Korean state is based upon the idea that there will have to be an ultimate war with American imperialism, that there's nothing we can do to make them behave any better, that they're absolutely committed to this course of folly. They've starved their own people till they're 6 inches shorter than a South Korean to make this happen. The idea that if we were more warming and gentle to them, that they would be less aggressive is ridiculous. And I think very dangerous, as well as I have to say, somewhat humiliating.
I don't consider
my hatred of and suspicion of the North Korean regime to be the contributing cause to the revolting way in which it treats its neighbors and its people.
You have to learn to call
these things by their right names.
I didn't say that our treatment of North Korea is what had contributed to its behavior. I had said. It's at least possible, and my view of the intrinsic and eternal obstinance of the regime is not quite as severe as yours. I grant that it's kind of a tough case, but what I said was that their assessment of the carrots and sticks that we were laying out and continued to lay out was colored by what they had seen. In Iraq, when Iraq came into essential compliance with the fundamentals of what we ask in terms of letting in inspectors, and we invaded and deposed their ruler and ultimately killed him anyway. That's not a way to encourage people to let inspectors into their country. I think you'd agree. But, as long as we're on the subject of upsides and downsides of the Iraq war...
That's why they fire a missile right across Japan. Without warning, the Japanese find one day a missile's been launched, flies over their country and lands on the sea on the other side. Of course that's going to happen because the United States invaded Iraq.
You'll be happy to hear I don't see a causal relationship there. So we agree on that. But as long as we're on the subject of the costs and benefits of the Iraq war, but there's one, we're running out of time, there's one I'd like to ask about in particular. I think everyone agrees that the situation in Pakistan, where you have a radical insurgency... and you have nuclear weapons, is massively more dangerous than anything that we now know we actually faced in Iraq. Pretty much everyone agrees that the focus on the Iraq war distracted us from the whole Afghanistan-Pakistan region in a way that exacerbated that situation. I would think that alone comes close to being a damning indictment of the Iraq war. You obviously must disagree because you still... think the Iraq war was a good idea, so do you not concede any connection between those two?
I've always thought that's a totally bogus argument, if you don't mind my using that word, because Iraq was in our future no matter what. We can't say, because of Afghanistan, we cancel Iraq. We this huge country on the Gulf, at a choke point of the world economy, exactly between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Sorry to the Iraqis and to everyone else. We can't pay attention to that now. We're all tied up in Afghanistan. That would be not just to cease to be a superpower, it would be to cease to be a thinking country, at all. Iraq, unfortunately, forced itself upon us, and I think that, in a very, admittedly, very clumsy and incompetent way, we finally lived up to long-inherited responsibility.
I
also think you're wrong at the other end of your syllogism, in that everything we needed to know about the danger from Pakistan and in Pakistan was available to us and should never have, for no reason at all, under no pressure, have wavered. I wrote an article which you can look up easily. It's in a collection of mine called Love, Poverty and War. Long report from Pakistan, just after 9/11, long before any real confrontation with Iraq was in the offing, saying exactly why this is a terrifyingly dangerous place. There was no one. If you are exculpating any American official who didn't do their job in pointing to that danger, if you say to them, allow them the exit clause. Oh well, we were all so busy with Iraq we couldn't be bothered. No, we were a long term, very heavy commitment in Pakistan. And we played it wrong, and we still are playing it wrong. It's not because of Iraq that we fail to see that Pakistan still wants Afghanistan as its colony, and that it invented the Taliban in order to have a dependency, a client state in Afghanistan. And it did that long before 9/11, and that it wants to do this because it wants strategic depth for a war with India over Kashmir, and that it is India, the only other multi-ethnic, multicultural, secular, democratic superpower in the world of that scale, that we should be making an alliance. Our whole policy now is dead wrong in the AFPAC keyhole through which we look at these things, because it ignores the two potential superpowers in the region, India and Iran. Getting those two things right are what's important.
Okay,
Iraq makes no difference to this argument at all.
Let me do two things, running out of time. Well, first, I'll just, for the record, say I don't accept your contention that Iraq was foisting itself upon us as a major security problem and was bound to remain one. I just think, we actually, in fact, no one was even claiming that Iraq had an actual nuclear weapon or a true biological weapon in the sense of a biological weapon that is contagious and for which we lack a vaccine.
No, I don't mean the weapons threat, Robert. I'm sorry. I mean the fact that Iraq was a country falling to pieces on the Gulf. It was because of the sanctions, which were necessitated by its refusal
like
to come into compliance.
But,
and because of the fascistic nature of the regime, we were looking at another country like Congo or Rwanda turning into a black hole on the Gulf, a terrible, maimed, wrecked, traumatized place, as indeed has partially happened in spite of the intervention.
Well, yesterday, five bombs blew up in Baghdad and killed over 100 people, so I wouldn't say, looking at that and the previous 6 years, we entirely avoided chaos in Iraq. But
well, I already know the last people you're going to blame for those bombs are the people who rigged them and set them off. There must be a better explanation than that.
It's not a question of blame. The people who set those bombs are culpable. It's a fact of the matter that had we not invaded Iraq, those five bombs would not have been set off. And we're closing this with the distinction I was trying to drive home at the beginning, the distinction between a clear causal analysis and the question of blame. If you cannot divorce yourself, if you cannot divorce those two things, if you continue to conflate them, as right-wing propagandists love to do, you will never be able to get clear on the consequences
of foreign policy. I'm curious to ask you, do you think
policy.
The bombs in the Madrid train station and in the London subway system are also a result of the invasion of Iran?
I don't know enough. I suspect that they might not have happened, but I don't know. But in any event, the people who set them are culpable for those bombs. Let me say, as I said, I wanted to do two things in closing. One is just assert that, for the record, I don't buy that party premise. The other is, let me close by A, giving you the last word, and B, perhaps self-servingly, giving it to you in a realm where I'm not positive I disagree with you anyway. It's this question of Afghanistan and Pakistan. I feel so unsure on what the smart thing to do is in that realm, and you sound like you have some ideas. So in closing, I would let you, first of all, just A, say whatever you want to say, and I promise not to reply about anything you said, but B, I would like to hear what your recommendation is about that what we do in Afghanistan and Pakistan now.
Well, it's very generous of you, but I mean, I don't feel I need a free kick, as it were. I think the two things that are wrong with the president's speech are, first, the sense of history, and second, the sense of geography. this is actually a historic engagement that we have with that region, and it's part of being the United States. There's no sense in which we can disengage or withdraw from. It's puerile to think so, and we have to think in terms of decades and centuries. And he thinks in terms of electoral cycles, and that was pathetically obvious and made him do the self-evidently silly thing of, roughly speaking, saying how we will strengthen our hand by announcing when we'll fold it. They've been playing catch-up on that trivial point ever since. This is going to go on for the rest of my life and my children's lives, this confrontation. Second, it's wrong geopolitically. The narrow, little tiny telescope with which we look at it, the so-called AFPAC, is a provincial and parochial perspective. The critical thing is to get right our relationship with the great secular multicultural democracy, India, which is the regional superpower. Currently, we seem to be saying we take the Pakistani side in that quarrel. We don't, explicitly said by General McChrystal, we don't want India interfering in Afghanistan, where it's been a big help in providing aid and money and materials to the Afghan people, as it was to the Northern Alliance who were fighting the Taliban before we were. And second, if we don't get Iran right, if we don't find a way of putting ourselves simultaneously, and again it's history and geopolitics, on, for the first time in our history, on the democratic side in Iran, on the side of the people, and against their oppressors who are trying to guarantee themselves against regime change, as Saddam Hussein did by the illegal acquisition of nuclear weapons. So we don't get that right as well. We are done for in this area. So what I would like is a president who had some sense of history, had some sense of geopolitics, and also some sense of the right side to be on. Actually, it's quite possible to get all those three things in alignment. I think it's impossible to have a policy that doesn't, by the way. Any policy that doesn't do all three is doomed. It's not even stopgap. We're rewarding the Pakistani regime that invented and still sponsors the Taliban. We put it like this. We pretend to pay them to stop doing it, and they pretend to stop doing it while taking the money. This is A, humiliating, short-term and limited, and three, doomed to fail.
Okay. Well, as I said, I'll let you have the last word.
Well, you would be, I mean, I almost wondered how much more generous you'd be. Thank you anyway.
I enjoyed this. I always enjoy, your writing is inevitably thought-provoking, Christopher.
Thank you.
And it provokes a number of reactions from me, and men, I would say thought is among them. And I thank you for coming on.